South Korea's unification ministry confirmed that, yes, this building was imploded, and the footage was quite dramatic.
Drama that may have wedged another space between North and South Korea. This is the 17th of June, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, Indian and Chinese troops clash at the Himalayan border with casualties on both sides. Beijing city government raises its COVID-19 emergency response level. As relations seemingly worsen, the U.S. Secretary of State will soon meet with Chinese officials. We'll explore that with you. And the U.N. Human Rights Arm holds a debate over claims of systemic racism by the United States. It is all on today's VOA Asia. North Korea has followed through on its threat to demolish the de facto inter-Korean embassy just north of the border. Joining us is Bill Gallo. He is the VOA Korea correspondent. He joins us from Seoul. Bill, what happened? Why did this happen?
This is a move that North Korea has sort of been telegraphing for several days. They've been in this phase of a ramping up of provocations. They have a long history of ramping up provocations with South Korea in order to push for certain concessions. They had threatened for many days to destroy this liaison center that lies just north of the border with South Korea. And in fact, they followed through this afternoon. There were reports in South Korean media that there was an explosion. Then there were reports that smoke was emerging. Then a short time later, South Korea's unification ministry confirmed that, yes, this building was imploded, and the footage was quite dramatic. This was just a large four-story steel and glass building that was imploded upon itself. I imagine we will see high-quality video of this tomorrow whenever North Korean state media report on this. This is sort of a PR move for them, if you will. They're wanting to put pressure on South Korea and the United States, and they're doing it with this very dramatic, symbolic step.
What does this do overall to the relationship between North and South Korea?
Well, this has been part of a trend. This is not new. North Korea has been lashing out at South Korea for months. And in fact, they have already sort of abandoned that liaison center. It had pretty much sat vacant for months. South Korea actually pulled out its officials in January, but there's been very little contact between the two sides in months. North Korea is adamant about putting pressure on the United States via South Korea. North Korea very badly wants economic concessions from South Korea in the form of perhaps aid or things like that, perhaps maybe more economic exchanges with the South. But they also want the United States to relax sanctions. They believe that South Korea may be able to do that, and perhaps this is part of that strategy to put indirect pressure on the United States.
It seems like some of the orders are not coming from Kim Jong-un, but rather another family member.
That's right. Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, has taken a pretty big role in all this. And it's interesting because up until the last several months, she had sort of been seen almost as an aide to Kim Jong-un. She would carry his supplies and then sort of clear the path, if you will, for Kim Jong-un at these public events. That has changed pretty dramatically over the last few months. Now she publishes statements on her own. She seems to be in charge of inter-Korean relations. Sometimes she issues statements even mentioning the United States. And it's a reversal for her because she had sort of been sent as a sort of symbolic special envoy to South Korea in 2018, whenever there had been a warming of relations between the two Koreas. Now she's sort of like a wrecking ball, I think, for South Korea in order to put pressure on that relationship.
What about the South Korea leadership? How do you think they're going to react to this as this goes along? It's always been almost for Moon. It's almost been like a turn the other cheek so far.
Absolutely. This is something I think that is ideological for the current South Korean government. They need to pursue better relations with North Korea, and they will do so at a very big cost. It seems that North Korea is willing to impose an even greater cost for those efforts. It's not clear at what point the Moon administration here in South Korea will begin to suffer politically for these decisions. Internationally, they've received a lot of criticism for sort of looking weak, of sort of kowtowing to North Korean demands. But here in South Korea, there still is a very big appetite for improving inter-Korean relations. I think he does have some more room to push this effort. But if he doesn't have any cooperation from North Korea here at the end of the day, it's hard to see, just how long he can make that push.
Bill Gallo is VOA's Seoul correspondent. He joins us from there. Once again, Bill, thanks so much. We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We are also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. China must take charge of serious cases in Hong Kong that breach national security. That according to a senior Chinese official this week. The U.S. and China will each allow 4 weekly flights between the two countries, easing a standoff on travel restrictions in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Rights groups are worried that Malaysia is backsliding on free speech protections following the brief spell of a reform-minded administration. Pakistan releases 2 employees of rival India's embassy in Islamabad after briefly detaining them in connection with a hit-and-run road accident in the capital. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Indian defense experts on Tuesday warned of a repeat of a 1962 war between India and China after troops of both the nuclear-armed neighbors were involved in a violent face-off on the disputed border. 20 Indian Army personnel, including a colonel, were killed in a fierce clash with Chinese troops in the Galwan Valley Monday night, the biggest military confrontation in over 5 decades that has significantly escalated the already volatile border standoff in the region. D.S. Dillon is an Indian defense expert.
We have reached a situation where we were standing eyeball to eyeball, and this has resulted in the scuffle where we have lost our brave jawans. This is very sad, and we want government to immediately step in and take some diplomatic action so that does not happen like 62, that small incidents gets flared up and to the bigger level and we may have to go for a bigger action then.
Indian government sources said no shots were fired, but a physical fight broke out between the two sides, with soldiers using batons and throwing stones, which resulted in the casualties. China blamed India for the clash on Monday, and the editor of the government-controlled Global Times said the Chinese military had also suffered casualties. India and China have been locked in a standoff in the Galwan Valley in western Himalayas for weeks, with both accusing each other of trespassing into the other's territory. Former Indian diplomat T.P. Srinivasan said what happens now is questionable.
This time what I see is a more aggressive posture by the Chinese, which looks like a deliberate policy to create confusion between India, or rather deteriorate the relationship between India and China at the highest level. That is the feeling I get.
India and China fought a brief border war in 1962 and have not been able to settle their border dispute despite talks spread over 2 decades. Border guards have had skirmishes, even fisticuffs, when patrols have confronted each other, but there has been no loss of life at the border since bloody clashes erupted in the eastern Himalayas in 1967. Happening now in Asia, a senior Chinese official said China must take charge of serious cases in Hong Kong that breach national security as Beijing prepares to impose new national security laws in the city. The plan, which bypassed Hong Kong's legislature, would also allow Chinese national security organs to set up agencies in the city. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. China increased testing and lockdown measures in parts of its capital Tuesday to control what appeared to be its largest coronavirus outbreak in more than 2 months. The 40 new cases reported Tuesday included 27 in Beijing, bringing that city's total to 106 since Friday. AP correspondent Ken Moritsugo reports China is rushing to prevent the spread of a new coronavirus spike in a country that appeared to have contained it.
The number of cases in this latest outbreak in Beijing has risen over to 100 people. So the authorities here in Beijing have tightened controls to try to stop this outbreak from spreading any further. Now, a third neighborhood has been locked down. People aren't allowed to go to their houses. They've also told taxis and hire car services they can't take people outside of the city. And as well, anybody who lives in any of these high-risk areas isn't allowed to leave Beijing. They really don't want the virus to start spreading outside of the capital city. Their goal is to move quickly as soon as they discover anything like this to really try to shut it down and kind of go into overdrive. They're testing thousands and thousands, I mean, tens of thousands of people. There have been several spikes like this in various parts of the country since the crisis in Wuhan was brought under control. And I think it's inevitable that there will continue to be little spikes of this coronavirus at any time in any place. I mean, we don't have a vaccine for it, and it moves around quietly because often the people who first have it don't show any symptoms. And then all of a sudden it sort of bursts out in a big surprise.
Many of the recent cases have been linked to Beijing's Xinbadi wholesale market, and authorities have been testing market workers, anyone who visited the market over the past 2 weeks, and anyone who came into contact with either group.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Cambodian authorities have launched a manhunt for the owner of a business reportedly behind batches of herbal rice wine, which has poisoned dozens of people and killed at least seven. The wine has been linked to more than 40 cases of poisoning in a rural province near Cambodia's border with Thailand. All of the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Hundreds of lychee farmers sort and grade huge piles of the tropical fruit at a busy wholesale market in the northern Vietnam province of Bac Giang. But many bemoan slumping prices as foreign traders were held up in quarantine. Vietnam usually exports around 100,000 tons of fresh lychees worth more than $30 million U.S. dollars each season to China, Japan, Australia, and the U.S. But business is down this year as Vietnam keeps its borders shut. Nguyen Van Tan, a lychee farmer, had this to say about the situation.
This year, because of the pandemic, we don't see Chinese traders, so we mostly sold to domestic traders. So the price is very low.
Foreign buyers tend to come directly to the market, just a few hours' drive from the Chinese border during the fruit's short six-week season. But state media reported last week several hundred from China and Japan had been quarantined for 14 days. Despite authorities saying they would promote domestic consumption, prices have dropped to half what they were last year. Already a major coffee, rice, and catfish exporter, Vietnam has in recent years turned its attention to fruit. Last year, it exported $3.76 billion worth of fruit and vegetables. Chickens in Pakistan have been feasting on captured locust under an initiative to combat swarms of the insects that are threatening food supplies in the impoverished country. Prime Minister Imran Khan has endorsed plans to expand a pilot project in the breadbasket province of Punjab, where villagers earn cash to gather locusts that were then dried out, shredded, and added into poultry feed. Farmers are struggling as the worst locust plague in 25 years wipes out entire harvest in Pakistan's agricultural heartlands, leaving people scrambling for income. Mohammad Khurshid from Pakistan's Food Ministry and the biotechnologist Johar Ali set up the program, drawing on efforts in war-ravaged Yemen, where authorities have encouraged people to eat the protein-rich locust amid famine. For a reward of 20 rupees, which is about 12 U.S. cents per kilogram of locust, locals worked all night to collect them. One farmer who lost all of her crops to the insects said she and her son earned 1,600 rupees, about $10, during a single locust-gathering outing, helping to offset the financial damage. Organizers struggled at first to convince farmers to join the hunt, but by the third night, word had spread and hundreds joined in, turning up with their own bags to stuff full. The ministry, which recently announced the results of February's pilot, is now preparing to expand the project to other locations. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo plans to meet a Chinese delegation at a U.S. military base in Hawaii this week to discuss bilateral ties amid heightened tensions that have recently been exacerbated by anti-U.S. propaganda from China's state-controlled media outlets. The world's two top economies have been at odds over trade, the coronavirus pandemic, and China's new security legislation in Hong Kong. Dr. Roy Denny is the senior fellow and U.S.-China relations expert at the East-West Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. He spoke with VOA's Lori London about the significance of the meeting.
Reportedly, he's meeting with Yang Jiechi, who's a former foreign minister and now has moved on to an even higher ranking position. So the Chinese are treating it as a pretty serious meeting. You could say that U.S.-China relations have, you could say, three dimensions: a strategic dimension, an economic dimension, and an atmospheric tone of the relationship dimension. And all three of those dimensions are in a downturn at the moment.
So why now? Is this politically driven, given that this is an election year? Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, first of all, the relationship being in such a trough is reason enough for the two countries to understand that they still need each other. They still need a constructive relationship, and they need to get the relationship back on the track where they can at least cooperate on issues of common concern. But even that's in danger at this point because there's been such a deterioration this year. But when you say politically motivated, I think you mean domestic politics.
Correct.
Certainly, it's an advantage for both the Chinese government and the U.S. government in front of their respective domestic audiences to appear to be capable of managing this important relationship well. And it's especially valuable if both of them can argue to their domestic audiences that they got a win. So the real challenge here will be, after the meeting, both sides to be able to go home and say, I got some progress from the other side on an issue that's important to us. But of course, it's difficult for one to win without the perception of the other losing. That's where the political gamesmanship comes into play.
What issues do you think will be highest on the agenda to try to resolve, and are they actually feasible?
There's some important political / strategic issues that need discussing. Hong Kong is probably at the top of the list, but also North Korea. The United States and China have sort of gone their separate ways on North Korea over the last year or so. The Taiwan issue is, again, becoming more salient, as there's at least a perception that, based on a lot of media reports, that China is getting a step closer to seriously considering military action. But I think that the issue where there's the greatest likelihood of progress being made is the economic issue, particularly picking up the pieces of the phase one of the U.S.-China bilateral trade agreement.
Do you think that's something that can be accomplished?
I think that's a feasible goal because it's in the interest of both countries to get the situation back to at least an even keel, with both countries facing some economic difficulty as a result of the pandemic, especially to not have the additional problem of an upsetting of supplies and supply chains with such an important economic partner. It really becomes important in domestic politics of both countries. Also, it's an area where both sides can sort of claim a win.
It's interesting you mentioned the pandemic, of course, because we've been hearing the Trump administration blaming China quite a bit for this. I know that angered China quite a bit.
Generally, when there's a meeting like this, both sides will make their own opening statement, and I don't know that the rhetoric will get put aside. Both will have an opportunity to sort of vent, but then beyond that, once they state their basic grievances with the other side, that's when the real work begins. It's a matter then of crafting some areas where they can cooperate and agree, despite not everything being fixed at that atmospheric level, including the acrimony over the pandemic.
And what about the contentious Hong Kong law? Will Chinese officials even be willing to discuss that?
I expect that that will be one of the areas where both sides offer an opening position that seems to offer no room for accommodation by the other side. They're completely irreconcilable. But beyond that, with the Hong Kong issue, there's actually some room for moderation on both sides. That is, the Chinese could interpret and implement the new law on national security very strictly and very expansively in such a way that creates a lot of additional political problems. Or they could leave it at sort of a symbolic stage, at least for now, not press on the accelerator, get the law passed, very cautious about how they implement. And on the U.S. side, the options range from the United States completely disavowing any special relationship that Hong Kong has with the United States and treating it just like every other part of China for all purposes. But on the other hand, the United States has the option of standing pat with the tough speech that President Trump made that we might do certain things, but then actually implementing our retaliation for what the Chinese are doing in a very limited and targeted, even symbolic way.
We've been hearing a lot about how China has taken advantage of the unrest here in the United States over some of the racial injustice, police brutality issues. Would you agree with that, that China is capitalizing on that?
The answer is absolutely yes. The Chinese are taking advantage of the turmoil in the United States over the issue of racially motivated police brutality. I see it as a continuation of the place that the Chinese had got to in the rhetorical battles with the United States during the pandemic. The Chinese started out sort of in defensive mode, and then as they perceived they're being attacked by the United States government and other countries, then they moved to a more offensive mode. And where they ended up at the end of May was frequently raising the idea that the United States, based on its pandemic response in the United States and its accusations of China as being the source of the disease and not handling it well and causing more problems for the rest of the world, which the Chinese are very unhappy about. The Chinese outward-reaching diplomacy latched onto the theme of the U.S. pandemic response proving that the United States is not fit to be a world leader. And the disturbances in the United States now and the attention given to police brutality has now given the Chinese a lot more fodder, which they have used to continue that argument, specifically that the United States talks a lot about human rights, criticizes human rights, particularly in China, but the United States is hypocritical in doing this because we now see that the United States is full of problems itself. Therefore, it ought to not only stop raising these issues with other countries, but shrink from its claims to international leadership on this or other issues.
VOA's Lori London speaking with Dr. Roy Denny, Senior Fellow and U.S.-China Relations Expert at the East-West Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. Delegates attending the 43rd session of the UN Human Rights Council are holding an urgent debate on alleged systemic racism and police brutality in the United States. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tragic events unfolded May 25th in the U.S. city of Minneapolis, the police killing of African-American George Floyd triggering an urgent debate. This is only the fifth time in the UN Human Rights Council's 14-year history such an event will take place. The request for the racism debate was made in a letter signed by more than 50 African nations to the president of the council, Austrian Ambassador Elisabeth Tichy Fisselberger. The letter states the death of George Floyd is not an isolated incident, noting other people of African descent have suffered the same fate due to what authors of the letter say is unchecked police brutality in the U.S. The African countries are calling on the Council to urgently address the systemic racism that produces such racial violence, particularly against people of African descent throughout the world. Tichy Fisselberger tells VOA discussions will not just focus on one country, but will examine racism elsewhere.
When I said it's not against the United States, I mean there is complaints about a lot of racism in many countries of this world, of course in Europe, but not only. You find it all over the world. And if you listen to what people have to say, I think they will just come up with statements on describing different situations in different countries.
Both delegates and non-governmental organizations will take part in the UN Human Rights Council debate. A resolution is likely to be adopted at the end of the event. Tichy Fisselberger says the United States, which is not a member of the Council, normally does not attend Council meetings. She says U.S. delegates most likely will follow the debate via webcast, which is in line with what it has been doing recently. The U.S. has not commented. However, the U.S. ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Andrew Bremberg, issued a statement last week expressing horror, anger, and grief at what he called George Floyd's senseless death. He said the public reaction in the U.S. following this tragedy showed the American people's desire to overcome racial injustice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Papuboon, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe, then enjoy the day ahead.